I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hi, this is Ryan Fraser.
This is Troy Daly.
This is Gus Boyett.
This is Don Hutchison.
This is Jürgen Klopp, and you're listening to The Big Interview with Graham Hunter.
Thank you, Jürgen. I travelled to all these interviews from Barcelona, and our socios, our beloved members, keep us on the road. This independent podcast would not happen without them. Please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter right now to become a socio, to become one of our members. And get an extra big interview every month, plus loads of bonus content. So go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter, patreon.com/Graham Hunter, and we'll bring you joy. Welcome to The Big Interview. I'm Graham Hunter. Kind of you to join us. I'm happy that you're here. More chat about football and life. This episode, number 98 in our interview series in the beginning, 98, you beauty. This is with John Hartson. Beyond being a very successful footballer and somebody who has been tested by life, John stuck in my consciousness ever since 95, 96, when I moved from being a part-time journalist to a full-time football journalist, and I was flying back from Turin with Tommy Burns, then the Celtic manager, having taken him on a three-day trip to visit Marcello Lippi and Gianpietro Ventroni, the fitness trainer at Juventus. And on the flight back, Tommy was giving me an interview. And he said, off the record, as Celtic manager, he was desperate to sign John Hartson. And I'll admit, at that time it startled me. I couldn't quite see why this John calls himself a raging bull at that age, a patently talented but not refined striker coming through at Arsenal, having made his mark at Luton, was so attractive to Tommy Burns, a man who'd shown real astuteness in signing for his club, George Cadet and Andy Tom and Paolo Di Canio, etc. So I began to follow John. I began to speak to people who knew him at that early age, and throughout his career I have thought that he's something of an underestimated footballer. I ended up in one of the Celtic Barcelona ties working for STV as a summariser alongside John, and I found him to be not only friendly and helpful, but a really interesting guy. In this first part, again, recorded at a distance because of the conditions that all of us at this stage are suffering thanks to the pandemic, therefore slightly different sound quality than normal. There's lots to like here, I'd say. But I recommend that you listen out for a description of John's apprenticeship at Luton under Mick Harford. Mick is a legendary figure in the game, and whether you've heard of him, whether you watched him, whether you feared him, or whether you don't know who Mick Harford is, John's description of the guy he had to go and work for, and how bad he could be, to other people, not John, takes you right back to the apprenticeship system and gives you a brilliant portrait of Mick Harford. Beyond that, there are lots of different topics in this first part, and John begins by talking about his most testing centre-half opponent, somebody who will probably surprise you, somebody who wasn't John's size, and somebody who, when John looked at him in the tunnel at Mestalla in Valencia, thought, aye, aye, tonight's going to be a piece of cake. And it wasn't. Welcome to Big Interview 98 with Mr. John Hartson, Part 1.
So, listeners, hello, this is the big interview in detention. Dear listeners everywhere, I don't know what I did. I didn't look at the teacher in a bad way. I've never had detention that lasted this long in my life before. But one of the things that's bright, you know, when you're in detention and the classroom's all stuffy and it's 4:45 and you want to go home, one of your mates comes to the window and just pushes his nose against the window and makes you laugh. We've got one of those. The man who talked me through only my second appearance on the Parkhead pitch, which was as a quivering reporter for Celtic versus Barcelona. And I had Mr. John Hartson to my right-hand side. He talked me through the whole game and the whole performance. John, thank you for coming and rescuing the big interview from detention. It's generous of you.
Ah, you're more than welcome, Graham. I've always wondered. I've watched you over the years doing several interviews and podcasts, and I've seen you at regular places, games and everything. But this is one of the first times we get to have a really good football chat, and I'm looking forward to it.
And still, you subject yourself to this. That means you're a strong, strong man. If you've seen me before, then it was an excuse to run and say, rubber ear, lads. John, look, everybody that's listening knows the basis of this interview. And I want to ask you, I want to test you a little bit, because I think I know the answer to the question, but I'd like a description. Because, John, in this interview, what we've often done is we've taken specialists in their position and we've asked them about their art. Now, I think that of all the central defenders that were beaten by you, bullied by you, outthought by you, outjumped by you, tricked by you, you've said in the past that it was a wee guy with lanky long hair who was at least one of your toughest central defence opponents, and that was Roberto Ayala. El Raton, he was called. The Mouse. Can you believe he was called the Mouse? John, that was Celtic against Valencia in the year before your run to a third European final on your part. Please, for those who don't understand Ayala or the art of a centre forward against a central defender, why did you name Ayala as your trickiest opponent? Describe him and the situation, will you?
Well, first of all, that was against Rafa Benitez's Valencia in the Champions League, the group stages. This was the game. Can't recall what year.
It's December 2001. And as you say, it's a home and away tie in the group stage. And, I mean, look, just for everybody else, there was no test of memory for you. Valencia line up with Canizares, Pellegrino, Fabio Aurelio, the man, Roberto Ayala, Miroslav Djukic, the sweeper, Amadeo Carboni, brutal, hard Italian fullback, Curro Torres, Vicente, the brilliant winger, Pablo Aimar, Gonzalo de los Santos, John Carew, then Anglama and Mista on the bench, and Rafa Benitez was the coach. You're right, John. But it was that, you know, it was that battle with Ayala why was he such a tough opponent?
Well, the reason for that, Graham, was I generally had really good success as a centre forward against players of the ilk, let's just say for argument's sake, Gareth Southgate, Chris Perry, Jamie Carragher, players that couldn't match me physically for my strength. And I could bully them. I could roll them. You know, I'd win almost every header that came into me. They couldn't get around me. And I looked across at the tunnel. I was in the tunnel that night against Valencia at the Mestalla. And I remember Valencia had the white kit, didn't they, with the black shorts. And I'm looking at Ayala, and I'm honestly thinking to myself, I'll be all right tonight. I'll be fine. I thought, I'm bigger than him. I'm stronger than him. Play it into me. I'll beat him in the air. I'll roll him. I'll bully him. And from the first minute, he was up for the challenge. He was like a rock. He was so hard and strong. For somebody who was about 5'9", 5'10", he outjumped me. Whenever I sort of tried to bully him, he was giving it as much back. Great defender. He was toe-poking the ball. If I tried to get hold of it, he would put his foot through the middle of my legs, poke it away. If he couldn't win it, you know, in front of me, he'd try and get his body on his legs in and around the ball, so he'd make it messy for me as a striker to get a hold of it and link play. And I was just incredibly impressed with him. And I come off that night, and we got beat 1-0. If it hadn't been for Rab Douglas, actually, it would have been 6 or 7. They were an unbelievable side. Pellegrino alongside him, by the way, he must have been 6'6". So that was another, a physical sort of battle that I had. I remember Aymar, what a player he was.
Fabulous.
Incredible. A little bit like David Silva, wasn't he? That type of player. Thread balls through with the correct weight and set things up and just very, very good on the ball, took it brave. But Roberto Ayala, I always say, Graham, because the ones I generally struggled against were Steve Bruce, Neil Ruddock, Gary Pallister, Dave Watson, defenders who could match me physically because they were tough, they were strong. And back then, you know, when I was coming through, I signed for Arsenal 26 years ago now. So in the late sort of 90s, you know, the referee would say, "Oh, John, keep your elbows down." He'd give me a free kick, and then 5 minutes later, he'd give it against me. And I could say to the ref, "Oh, come on, ref, any chance?" And he'd wink at me and say, "You get the next one." So there was physical battles going on all over the pitch, but it was the big physical centre-halves who were same weight as me, had the same presence as I did. And then I felt the smaller ones, it was an easy day for me because I was so strong. And that's why I built my career on backing in and holding. But that night in Valencia against Roberto Ayala, he didn't allow me to do that. And I was surprised that he was so good for someone that was so small. He could jump, physically strong, he was quicker, and he was just outstanding. I just had a really difficult night against him.
There's a phrase here, John, in Spain, which is called mala leche. And it's daft. It's like a lot of Spanish. It doesn't translate really well because it just means bad milk. But we would say that somebody was a bad bugger. How much within you, because you've used the phrase bully a lot there. And I think part of that is sports bullying in terms of making sure that psychologically you dominate them. If there's a physical edge, proving it. But there's another side to a centre-half, centre-forward battle. The mala leche, the bad bugger part, sometimes it would go off between a striker and a centre-half. Did you have that nastiness inside you naturally?
Well, I was what you would call a physical header of the ball. I would get across people and I would almost get a 1-2-3, get a jump, and then my knee would go into the side of the defender, and I wouldn't just win the header, I would win the header at ease. I would get so far above them and I would sort of physically head the ball, either flick it on or bring it down or head it back. And I was naturally aggressive. I wouldn't say I was nasty. You know, we might go on to the Ayla Berkovic incident later on, you know. And I think with that incident, I always say, you know, I'd spent 20 years, 15 years trying to build up a reputation of being not only... You look at it, George Graham bought me for my physicality at 19. Joe Kinnear took me to Luton. George Graham, I worked with Arsene Wenger. Martin O'Neill signed me. Harry Redknapp signed me. Some of the biggest managers in the game signed John Hart. They didn't sign me for I was quick and I run the channels and I had, you know, I could take 6 or 7 players on and pass the ball. They signed me because they saw somebody that would give everything, somebody that would battle with defenders. He'd be a focal point. He'd be our main man to hit up front. He had good feet. He could head the ball and he could score goals. So my game was based around my physicality. Now, I'm not saying I wanted to hurt people, but I went out onto the pitch very physical. I was up for the challenge and I didn't fear. I didn't fear them challenges, even from a very young age. I don't think it's nasty. I just think it's people feared you. You wanted to put fear into the centre-halves, if you like. That's what I wanted. And I think I did that lots of times.
Did you win any in the tunnel? Did you think, like, last time I did this guy and I can see he's not really... In the tunnel, did you look and think, yeah, I got this guy?
Well, I used to have a look at the players and, you know, used to think, oh, maybe I could get the better of him or that. But the other thing was as well, Graham, which is interesting, I didn't ever talk to players. I never spoke to the opposition. You know, I never tried to intimidate them by any language or speaking. I always felt if I spoke to them, it would affect my game. I was like a silent assassin, if you like. I'd be silent, you know, and then I'd knock them over. I'd pick them back up. Always pick them back up because you felt the referee might give you a bit of sympathy and you get away with a booking, you know. If you went and beat somebody in the air, then he fell on the floor. If you picked the lad up, and the referee probably let you off for that rather than if you snarl at them over them, then he might give you a yellow card. But I never liked the verbals. I never ever spoke to the opposition players. I just liked to go and do it, you know, as it came along.
When you were still very young, just 20, Arsenal's run to the Cup Winners' Cup, which we'll come to in a minute, meant that you played the UEFA Super Cup and you'd pleased and impressed first George Graham and then his assistant, Stuart Houston, so much that you were easily Arsenal's first-choice striker. And the Super Cup's against AC Milan, in the days when they're still immensely powerful, they've got world-class footballers everywhere.
On the European Cup in 94, hadn't he?
Yeah, so they're European Cup winners. Now, tell me, when you go up at that age and that raw for all your physicality and for all your promising talent, you went up against, if I'm not wrong, Desailly and Costa Curta, both at Highbury and in San Siro. How ready were you? Did people give you notes on them? I know I'm asking you to go back a long way, but also, I mean, they were just outstanding. They were truly, in Costa Curta's, in my impression, John, he was the defender's defender, always alert. He was an Anglophile. He loved English football, which is why the Italians call him Billy Costa Curta. Desailly in that era was one of, he literally was one of the great European footballers of the previous 20 years, and he remained so. He didn't put a foot wrong in the final until the final in 98 and winning the World Cup. He was the player of the tournament for me, way beyond Zidane. At 20, at barely just turned 20, were you ready for them? What did you learn from them? What was the experience like?
Well, first and foremost, Graham, I had to be ready because as far as I was concerned, we'd lost two centre-forwards. Alan Smith had retired. Alan Smith, the year before, scored the winning goal against Parma in Malmo. Won the Cup Winners' Cup. That's why we met. Cup winners faced the European champions, and we met in what we call the Super Cup. And the first game at Highbury was Paul Merson's comeback game, having been in a priory for so long. And we drew 0-0 at Highbury. Then we go over to the San Siro, and we get beat 2-0. But I felt as if I did very well. It was actually Costa Curta and Baresi. They were the two. Desailly played in the middle of the park alongside, well, Maldini played left back. And I just felt, because I was so young and I was just so fresh and I was just enjoying it. You know, I hadn't ever heard of Costa Curta. Or remember, a year and a half prior to that, I'm just coming out to Luton's first team. You know, in the old First Division, so I'm playing against Barnsley, and all of a sudden my move to Arsenal happens very quick. With all due respect, I know who they are now because they're absolutely magnificent Italian superstars, World Cup winners, Champions League winners, retired a Maldini shirt, number 3 shirt, you know, for AC Milan. But at that particular time, I was so young, I was so fresh that George Graham used to just say to me, he used to say, "Big man." Excuse my Scottish accent, but I managed.
That was George. You got him in one.
My wife is Scottish, so I've been learning a bit. He used to go, "Big man, win your heaters, all right?" He says, "And relax, just relax, win your heaters, big man, and calm down." That's what he used to say to me. And all I had to do, because Alan Smith he won the Golden Boot twice at Arsenal. He was a magnificent centre forward. You know, they'd had great success under Smudger. And I think George. With myself, I don't know whether I was a replacement for Spudger, but I was just somebody that he spent a lot of money on. I was Britain's most expensive teenager at 19 years of age. 2.5 million I went to Arsenal for. I think he had someone who was young, who was going to be around a long time, and I was incredibly aggressive and enthusiastic. And when I would imagine that when Costa Curta and Baresi see me running at them, young, no fear. I had no fear whatsoever. And I'm looking to head the ball, and they're probably thinking, oh, my God, I'm not getting into this wild animal's way here. And that's what I was like. So with all due respect, you know, I had great respect for them as time went on. And it was interesting because we played AC Milan for Celtic in the Champions League qualifiers again around about 2004, 2005. And Costa Curta played, right? And as I'm walking off the pitch, I've gone to shake his hand. And he looked at me and he said, "Are you still playing?" I was getting you cheeky so-and-so because he was older than me.
He was about 43 by then.
That's what he said to me. He said, "Are you still playing?" I went, "What was it? You still playing?"
See, John, that's the class of us. That's him getting in your head for the next time in case there's another next time. Ah, that's the psychology of a defender.
And that's what he said to me. So I remember Maldini played that night as well. Baresi had retired by then. But no, they were just great times. Almost thrown into a Super Cup final, and then the year after, I think, or it might have been the same year, we played in the Cup Winners' Cup final. You know, so I think people sometimes, you know, overlook the fact I'm only 20 years of age, Graham, and I've played in two European finals, you know, which when you look back now, it was remarkable times, you know, then.
You've made the jump from Luton to Arsenal, but I want to sort of expand that jump because, you know, when you're playing, let's say, 19, I think I've got your age wrong. I think it's 19 against Milan and then 20 by the time you face Saragossa the year. So at 19, you're about 5-6 years away from watching games at Swansea, watching games at the Vetchfield, and going down there and the 4-year on the train up and down to Luton. And I just wonder, this is a pure self-indulgence, John, and if it's a player that you didn't like or don't remember, then you can give me a little shrug and roll me and bully me physically. But you were able to watch a great hero of mine when I was growing up, Tommy Hutchison.
Oh, class. Tommy Hutchison played on the left, cut inside, cut back. He'd have driven me mad because I don't want the ball crossed in. But he could cut back, and he was a wonderful winger. And he was doing it in his 40s at Swansea, Graham. And I was only watching a video the other week when he scored in the FA Cup final for Man City. And then he scored that own goal in the same game. So, you know, sorry for interrupting, but Tommy Hutchison was somebody I stood on the North Bank at 10, 11, 12 years of age at the old Vetchfield with my father, watching Tommy Hutchison, Bob Latchford, Alan Curtis, Leighton James, Robbie James, Jeremy Charles, you know, Di Davis in goal, Adzi Abdic. Swansea were just my life at the time, and the North Bank was somewhere where my dad would take me. And it's always stayed with me. I'm born and bred in Swansea. And at that time, under John Toshack, what a team they had.
People forget that some of the names that you've been mentioning, and that Leighton James was a fantastic footballer for Burnley. And he used to have, I remember reading in Shoot, like these were the innocent days that he was. They were like, "How did you manage to go out for a night or out for the papers and not be?" He said, "I just put on," and he had a big Elvis Costello National Health glasses. He said, "I just put on my glasses and nobody recognises me." Like, different times.
He was class for Burnley as well, wasn't he?
He was fantastic for Burnley. And Di Davis, people forget about what a brilliant, because he was a Wales international goalkeeper for many, many years as well.
And I also watched Swansea then, the next team from that, which was Dudley Lewis. It was Andy Melville, Chris Coleman at left back. Players like Paul Rayner, Jimmy Gilligan, you know, just players.
John Yogi Hughes in due course.
John came there.
So that Swansea side took you to Europe because you had the famous games against Panathinaikos, didn't you?
Yeah, well, the fans got arrested, didn't they? They got held in Panathinaikos.
Was it 3-3? It was, I mean, one of the giants of European football. You get them at the Vetch. I mean, what did it feel like?
It was just incredible because the Vets used to host the Welsh internationals as well. It hasn't hosted one for a while now. The Liberty Stadium has, but the old Vets field used to as well. So they were great games. Swansea in Europe, you know, we just couldn't believe it. And the good thing about Swansea in recent times, they've had some really talented managers. I think they slipped out of the Premier League. They had seven seasons in the Premier League. You know, under Roberto Martinez, Brendan Rodgers took us into the Premier League, but then left for Liverpool.
They'd have had a League Cup final as well, wouldn't they? Did they know?
A league cup final under Michael Laudrup, of course, beating Bradford 5-0. The first proper trophy Swansea had won, you know, in the history, I believe, the Capital One Cup, I think it was called, Graham. And they played some brilliant football on their way to this progress. And they've slipped out now. And it's, you know, American-based owned club. And they've got a lot of shares. And it almost seemed to sell every asset. You look at last season, Daniel James went, McBurney went, the two IU brothers both went at one stage. But one of the IUs is back at the minute. Andre IU, sorry, is there right now. But, you know, they become a bit of a selling club, as if like they're trying to make some of the money back on the assets.
But you grew up in different days when the Vicksfield was muddy, when it was largely, it would have been aggressive, it would have been very proud, locally noisy. They might not have hit the heights, but I think you get taught as a person by the club that you begin watching at. I think you get taught by the atmosphere, by the people around you, by the players you see in front of you. I don't just mean a football club. What did it make it? What did it help make you growing up in Swansea in the 70s and 80s, specifically ideas, values, attitudes, behaviour? What has it left you with throughout your career? That
Graham, I was a fan. I was a fan. I was an avid Swansea City fan, and I would watch players from the North Bank, and it'd be 4,500 people there. Like, that was the crowds. It wasn't much bigger than that, 6 or 7 maybe. And I always loved it when the centre forward scored and then ran into the crowd, because I'd be in that crowd, and if you ran towards it, it'd just give you that, wow, what a feeling. And the centre forwards back then, as I says, it was like Paul Rayner. Scored a lot of goals. I don't want to go into the recently when it was Lee Trundle, Jason Scotland, obviously of late, recently McBurney, players like this. I loved the Swans when I was growing up, when I was 13, 14, 15 years of age. And it does really make you feel that I've always appreciated the fans. I've always had time for the fans of clubs that I've played for. You know, West Ham is a great crowd. Upton Park was a brilliant place to play. And if you notice, a lot of my goals, when I did score, I ran to the crowd. I ran to the crowd, that elation. And when you run, not so much, I ran into them a few times, but I'd have to avoid them and stay a certain, you know, distance away. But they were great, great days, listening to the chants and then to the opposition fans. But as I said, I grew up on the terraces, and then I lived the dream. I went on to become a professional myself.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Without stepping out of bounds, and tell me if I do, but Your mum worked in a psychiatric unit, is that right?
My mother worked as a psychiatric nurse for 22 years, yeah, in a psychiatric hospital.
If I make a comparison, over here, Gerard Piqué made a lot of the fact that when his mum worked in a spinal unit where people were trying to be rehabilitated as much as they could from car crashes or motorbike crashes, his mum used to take him in to say, look, kid, you know, this is what life can give you. Make the most of everything all the time. Was there an equivalent, I don't necessarily mean a visit, but was there an equivalent whereby your mum's experiences and what she lived through left her teaching you and telling you certain things?
Well, my mum, the hospital that she worked in, I'm trying to say this with all due respect to the patients and the people that were there, you know, they were taken off the streets because they were a danger to society. They were psychotic. And my mother worked as a night nurse. She used to get training in karate, my mother, as a nurse, because they had to give them training to deal with the patients if it ever was a problem. And I remember one Sunday afternoon, there was a patient. My mother said, all he's talking about, John, is you. He loves football and he wants to meet you. And I'd never been there in 21 years while my mother worked there. I was only about my late teens, but my mum worked there for a long time. And I went in there and she introduced me to this gentleman. And, you know, he was pretty much shook his hand and everything else. But I couldn't believe that my mum had put herself in a situation, night shift, where for me a lot of strange things happen in the night, Graham. From 1 o'clock till 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, it's dark, it's airy, you know. And my mum was up there looking after people that weren't allowed out onto the streets, you know, psychiatric nurse. Anything could have happened. She was so brave to do that. And I used to think to myself, I came away thinking, my mum, not that she had to, I love my mum, I still do to this day, but she went up in my estimation so far for the job and the work that she did by being at that hospital as working a night shift, 2 or 3 nights a week. And then she'd come home in the morning and she'd have to go into bed and she'd get us all ready for school. And my mum would generally then go and sleep a few hours in the day. We'd all be in school because she'd obviously done the night shift. And, you know, the job that she did up there, she came away in the end because she had an accident. I won't really go into it, but she had an accident. No. And then my dad almost said to her, right, you're not going back up there.
Did you ask her if she felt fear? Or was her professionalism and her training so much that she felt that they needed her?
It was that way. They needed her. She couldn't be scared. Even if she was scared, you know, she couldn't show that she was scared because that was her job. That's what she signed up to do. You know, if people had it, she could have got attacked. Somebody could have picked up a knife. You know, they could have ganged up towards her, anything else. But she was loved up there. She had a wonderful relationship with the patients. She was a fantastic nurse, and obviously, you know, that's my mother. So I maybe grown up with that sort of mental resilience, if you like, about seeing my mother and obviously realising what she'd done, and the respect there was enormous.
Paint me a picture, John, paint me a picture of a man that is legendary. He's probably a little bit less well known for his football, but Mick Harford. Mick Harford, there are certain people in football who carry a reputation for this or that. It might be humour. It might be an ability to live mental at night time, go crazy and still be brilliant on that.
Yeah.
There are people like Ricky Carvalho, who Benny McCarthy told me, useless in training, shit in training, Saturday 8 out of 10. Mick Harford carries one of those reputations because he's reputed to be just about the hardest man that played football in living memory. He becomes not just the guy to whom you're apprenticed, but in theory, the apprentice system then was supposed to be, and in the series we've covered all the bullying and the do this and the do that, you were supposed to learn. You were supposed to duplicate your senior pro's action. So two things in this stream, and I want to really paint a picture. Tell us about Mick Harford, the man, the footballer, and tell us about the process of being supposed to serve him, which is what an apprentice was supposed to do, but learn from him too.
Mick Harford is what I would call my an icon, along with Ian Rush, different players, was my idol growing up. I watched Rushy, obviously, but never got around him. When I joined Luton, Mick, not only was he a legendary figure, he was a magnificent centre-forward. Now, Mick was different to me. Mick wanted to hurt people. And he played in an era where he's going up against the likes of Brian Kilcline, Sam Allardyce, Alvin Martin, Alan MacDonald from QPR, Northern Ireland, you know, a monster of a man. And it was even worse, you know, the battles then. It was elbows up, a free-for-all at times. In the 80s, you know, you see, not mentioned the Billy Whitehursts and them type of alike of players. And we spoke about my aggression, and I worked for Mick for 2 years. I worked under him in terms of watching his every move, how he would lead the line, how he would get across people and take the ball down into his chest. And
John, that's it's a technical term, and occasionally in a series we start. People who listen to this love football, but explain. Pretend you're explaining to a 16-year-old junior and he's your apprentice. When you say get across, physically, what does that mean?
Well, it gets, what it means is you have to be in front of the defender when the ball, when a midfielder is looking to play it into the centre forward. There's no point being behind the defender unless you want to run in behind, like a Craig Bellamy. Craig Bellamy very seldom came short. He used to play on defenders' shoulders and run in behind. He never wanted to come short because he gave the defenders a chance to kick him and to win the ball. But Craig used to run in behind. Michael Owen was the same. Michael, a lot of the time, played on players' shoulders and they would run in behind. And the one thing defenders hate, Graham, is running back towards their own goal. That's what they don't like to do that. They like to play with the play in front of them.
But facing the ball.
As a centre forward, you know, good centre forwards like Alan Shearer, who I admired, you know, you've got to get your team up the pitch, right? If the team are defending, yep. and you've got to be an out ball, you've got to be a focal point. So when that ball comes into you from the right back or the left back or the midfielders, you've got to be there first. It can't come straight back in, so you're under pressure again. So you've got to get across that defender, come across his blind side, if you like, and arrive at the right time so you can either bring it down, take a touch, or if somebody's on, you can play it back first time. That's if you've got a decent touch. Mick and I, we had a good touch. So generally the managers like you to take a touch. Take a touch, don't panic, don't have 15 things in your mind. Just get a hold of the ball, hold on to it for a couple of seconds, allow us as a team to come up the pitch and have a breather. That's what good centre-forwards generally do. And if they can win a free kick, or if they can, you know, if they can get something off the referee, then that takes us right up the pitch and gives everybody a little bit of a respite. You see a lot of great centre-forwards, they arrive in the box. They arrive at the right time. They get across the defender. If you're already in there, you're almost easy to mark. You know, if you're already in there, you're almost coming away from the play and then you're arriving. It's the same as Mick used to get across the defender. The timing of his runs was outstanding. He'd get across the defender, so the last second, and bang, he'd stamp his feet on the floor. He's got it. He's in control. You're not getting the ball off me. Then he's got an out ball. He can go wide. He can go to the midfielders. He can try and play his other partner in, centre forward, whatever you want to do.
Was he a unit? Was he a physical specimen?
No, not really. He was thin. He was slender. He was about 6'4", slender. Probably weighed about 13, 14 stone. He had a size 12 Adidas World Cup boots, right?
And you knew from cleaning it.
Well, I knew because I was his boot boy. I was his apprentice. I used to have to get Mick's kit ready for him every morning on a peg. His jumper, his T-shirt, his shorts, socks, everything, and his boots had to be gleaming. We were all allocated with a professional, two professionals. For me, it was young Jason Rees, you might not have heard of him, from Wales, and Mick Harford. They were my two pros that I looked after. Wasn't like it is now. We used to clean the stands. our youth team manager used to go around the dressing room and put his finger across the top of the hooks to see if there's any dust on them. We used to go in and clean the baths, everything as apprentices.
Were you good at it?
Yeah, I was good at it. You had to do it. That was your job. You know, you had to train in the morning, make sure the players' boots. Then you have to get the boots at the end of the day. They'd all be in the big bucket. Take them out, clean them, prepare them for the next morning.
Was Mick an easy boss to have?
Brilliant. He was excellent with me. He'd come and watch us play as well, and we used to think that was brilliant. Luton's not a big place, but we used to, whenever Luton didn't have a game, or sometimes we had a midweek game, some of the first team players, Brian Steen, Tim Breaker, Mick Harford, Mark Steen, Les Seeley, poor Les, we lost Les a few years ago, Les Seeley. Even going back as Mal Donaghy, Danny Wilson, this is the team that I used to watch, you know, Ashley Grimes at left back, ex-Man United, Ashley Grimes.
That won the cup eventually, didn't they?
Brilliant team. David Priest as well. Again, Priest is not longer with us either. Ricky Hill, you know, they had some fantastic players, all managed under David Priest. So Mick, he was tall, gangly, all elbows, but Graham, what a touch. What a touch for a big man. He was fearsome. He was a brilliant character. He was one of them where Mick probably would call Mick nasty. Mick was a good coach. Did very well at Luton. You know, last season Luton got promoted, didn't they? For me, a great man and an awful lot of time for Mick Harford.
When you signed for George, you know, he loved you so much that he tried to sign you again at Spurs years later. But you go into that Arsenal squad, Highbury was properly special. You were around not just guys who represent the country, but characters of extraordinary power. And also a team that was that off the pitch was going awry, that was, you know, was behaving in ways, you know, as you said about Paul took time in rehab. I've seen him break down and cry when he talks about the devils he's had to cope with. Tony Adams has refound himself and given people so many chances through his rehabilitation work. But try to sum up the atmosphere or the people that you were around. And particularly, you know, if George only gave you that much coaching against Milan, there must have been more magic to George Stroller Graham than just like jump high, big man, and win your headers.
There would have been so much more to George. I remember before I got there, George Graham he'd won the double at Arsenal with a good group of players. When I got there, Graham, there was quite a big drinking culture at the club. You know, Tony Adams was drinking, Paul Merson. Take nothing away from George Graham, but I think the players took some liberties in the end, and they needed something like an Arsene Wenger to come along to reinvigorate some of these players, you know. And I think George, not to say, you know, he had a reputation of being a disciplinarian, but I think he loved his captain, loved Tony Adams, loved Paul Merson. We had Stuart Houston alongside him. Stuart was a great guy, great coach. But I think we had good players, as Stefan Schwartz, you know, and these type of players, John Jensen, Wright. Ray Parlour was in the team at that particular time. You know, and the back four speaks for itself, you know, Seaman, Dixon, Adams, Keown, Bowen, Winterburn.
But Were you daunted? Were you daunted? Because, you know... You've got to go and work with Ian Wright.
Yeah.
You know, Bergkamp comes along. It must have been a daunting challenge.
Do you know what, though, Graham? I was very young and I had the attitude that I can't be daunted because I'm going to fail otherwise. You know, you can't be a shrinking violet. When you're at a big club and playing in front of big crowds, you've got to perform every week. You know, a lot of people think that, you know, moving from a smaller club when you're outstanding to a big club, they can't cope with that big club mentality because you every time you lose, it's a crisis. It's all over the newspapers. You're marked. You're judged. It's London, and the London press can be horrendous. And I was going for record money.
Do you feel they were on your case?
Oh, 100%. Massively, massively on my case. You know, because they'd watched, you know, winning Arsenal teams and things like that. I got a terrible time off the press. Going back to George Graham, that I don't know what George feels about, but I think at that particular time when, you know, he was relieved of his job because of that, you know, the bung incident with the agent, I think at that particular time, I think Jordan had probably had his best days at Arsenal. And after that year when Stewart and Pat Rice took over, that was the year then they took us to the Cup Winners' Cup final. And a year or two later, Bruce Rioch came in, had an absolute stinker, Bruce Rioch. Signed Dennis Bergkamp, though, by the way. And then Wenger came in, and I think at that time, the players needed a Wenger to come in. They needed somebody like a genius type to reinvigorate and to revitalise their careers, and that's exactly what happened.
You think the players had taken over a little bit?
I think so, and maybe, you know, maybe George had just lost that fear, and I say that with all due respect.
I don't know if you remember much about Ozer and Sampdoria and then Zaragoza, but the thing that stands out to me is that a Sampdoria side you played against with Djurgovic and Vierkavod and Mancini was an absolutely sensational side. Sven-Göran Eriksson, the manager, and Samp had been used to getting to cup finals. They'd been to the Cup Winners' Cup final against Barcelona. They'd been to the European Cup final at Wembley in 92 against Barcelona. It was a side that was really experienced. You win 3-2 at home and lose 3-2 away.
We were very fortunate, Graham, because we won 3-2 at home. Brilliant night. Semi-final Cup Winners' Cup. We win 3-2 at Highbury in a close game. Did Steve Bowles score two headers?
Yes, Steve gets two headers at home. I think it's two bold and one for right, and Djurgovic scores twice for them in your home 3-2 win. But over there, it's very different.
In the away game, we go with 3-1 down, and an ex-Sampdoria player who came from Sampdoria to Arsenal for record money, Stefan Schwartz, he was Arsenal's record signing, he takes us to 3-2.
Can you claim the credit for dragging the wall or dragging the players? Because Stefan Schwartz's goal, it's from another postal fucking district, isn't it? It's not on the pitch yet. It's so far out. There's no way you should score. And the gap in the wall is... I don't know if you'd practice that or what.
But I don't know. I can't remember. We come from nowhere. We were 3-1. Probably not looking like we're going to score. And then Stefan pops up with this goal. It goes into extra time, goes to penalties. I take my penalty and score.
Sinisa Mihailovic misses. Lee Dixon scores. Djurgovic, who scored the two at Highbury in the first leg, he misses. McGoldrick misses. So when you're walking up to score, you've got two Sampdoria misses and you put the Arsenal 2-0 up, after which Maspero and Manini both score. Tony Adams takes the next penalty for Arsenal, after which it's fucking nuts. For a semi-final of the Cup Winners' Cup, Lombardo misses and Merson misses. If my flipping arithmetic is right, you're the man that makes it... Well, Tony Adams is actually the winning penalty kick, but if you miss, then it keeps on going. Was there tension? Did you feel pressure? Do you even remember thinking about the penalty kick?
Yeah, I remember it as if it was yesterday. No, I didn't feel it. I was young. Graham, you don't feel it when you're young. You know, you really don't when you're 18, 19, 20, 21.
Going up against a centre-half, but taking a penalty is a sphincter exercise, John. It doesn't matter about your age.
I was a centre-forward and I had to step up. I'm taking a penalty. If I miss, I miss. Of course I want to score. And of course I'm nervous. But I had to take one. And luckily for me, you know, I slotted it away and I scored. I missed some big penalties, by the way, in my career.
We'll come to that.
Yeah, it's 3-2. We go through. It's a fantastic night. My brother's there in Genoa watching that game. And we're now in the final. You know, and the one interesting thing was, we're in the final. It's 1-1. It's Snyder scores a great goal for them.
That one where he digs it, flicks it up, and lifts it.
30 yards, hits it on the turn. And then I equalise, and it goes into extra time. I'm knackered. We're all knackered. It's gone 120 minutes, right? I'm getting ready, Graham, to take a penalty.
Yeah.
Everybody's thinking now, right, this is going to penalties. The game was pretty dull. There was nothing happening on either side. The goalkeepers weren't really worked. Lo and behold, 9 pops up and absolutely kills it, and they take the trophy. Couldn't believe it.
I work with Naeem a lot. Super talented. And you've got to be brave, as well as technical, to put the ball on target from that distance, that tired, and under the bar. But to me, John, it's a hell of a mistake. And keepers have to carry the can for
everybody else's aspirations. There's your chance of a European medal gone. I'm not expecting that on the night people were at him. I'm sure they supported him, but it still strikes me as a terrible mistake. Am I wrong?
Well, I think David Seaman has gone down on record and said, "Look, that was a bad mistake." I think what happened was he was took by surprise. One, he's not expecting Naeem to shoot from there. Secondly, he probably admit he's too far off his line. But again, you're not expecting Naeem to shoot. And I think he actually gets to the ball, David Seaman, but then he almost flaps at the ball. It's like a soft wrist. And I am nobody to criticise David Seaman, because at one stage he was one of the best goalkeepers on the planet. At Arsenal, for them 2 years, I saw David Seaman make some tremendous saves. Even in the semi-final against Sampdoria, I think, if I'm not wrong, he saved one or two penalties during that shootout. He was a wonderful goalkeeper, so I can't really lay any blame on David.
Presumably the rehabilitation for an error like that starts in the dressing room, John. Can you remember, did people immediately go to David Seaman?
You go, Graham. That is the thing to do. Listen, in your heart of hearts, you could be going, what an error. You know, I can't believe he's done that. I can't believe he's let us down, blah, blah, blah. One or two of my people might be thinking that. But you go and give him a cuddle. You go and shake his hand and you say, look, you've saved us many times. It's one of those things. You can't throw him under the bus. You can't hang him out in that situation. Don't you think the one person who's suffering more than any of the other players is that man himself, is David Seaman. So he knows him. And it's etiquette. You know, it's the type of thing that nobody does that. You know, you'd have to be a wrong one in the dressing room to nail your goalkeeper for that. Even the managers wants to nail him, but I don't think they do.
You've talked about that really well, and maybe you're representing your point of view and Arsenal's dressing room that is, but it isn't that way in football all the time. One of the things, I'm not English, but got mad, I was reporting at Argentina 3-2 against, or no, 2-2 against England in the World Cup in 98, when Diego Simeone comes through the back of Beckham in what's a red card challenge. Kim Milton Nielsen, when Beckham flicks a little foot out at Simeone, yellow card Simeone for a red card challenge, and red cards Beckham for a yellow card piece of, and Hoddle has a go at him in the dressing room, then there's a go at him in the media. So the etiquette you've talked about is not one that exists right throughout football.
No, but for me personally, I couldn't do that to another player. I could go and kick a player, I could go and elbow a player, but if you're asking me to nail one of my own players, a teammate that I go out with every week, and he makes a mistake, I don't care how big the mistake is, for me personally, I shake his hand and I say, look, forget about it, it's an unfortunate situation, that's fine. I think a sending off, though, Graham, is slightly different to a mistake. Did David Beckham have to wave his foot like that? You know, and did Glenn Hoddle maybe look at Glenn Hoddle and Glenn Hoddle would say, well, I was right to give him a bollocking because he shouldn't kick his foot down in front of the referee. I think there's two scenarios here, by the way. I think they're both different. David Seaman's a mistake. He's too far off his line. He's taken by surprise. He can't quite get a strong hand to the ball, right? He's flew 50 yards. And then you've got David Beckham, right, who's on the floor. Referee's a yard away from him. And all of a sudden, he kicks out. Martin O'Neill hated ill discipline. Martin used to say, lads, we can't win with 10 men. It's hard enough to win with 11 men. It messes up all our shape, our tactics. You know, we're one down. It gives them an advantage. Remember, Alan Thompson got sent off at Ibrox in one game early in the season. And Martin O'Neill absolutely nailed him. He said, Alan, you've let us down. It's different if a man lets you down and gets sent off for something stupid. It's totally different than somebody making an honest... David Seaman didn't try to throw that ball in, did he?
Thank you for listening to The Big Interview. It's produced by me, which sounds egotistical, but it's also true, Graham Hunter, and Backpage. Our music is by Beer Jacket, who else? Editing by Charlie McGarry. Thank you to our hosts at Acast and our loyal sponsors at Bet365. We're also supported by our socios. Find out how to become a socio, how to support us,
at patreon.com/GrahamHunter. Here endeth the lesson.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.